Sunday Mornings with Yellowknife Vineyard.
And thankfully, and I'm really grateful for this congregation, we were not a congregation who were in conflict at all. So I never really was hanging on by my fingertips other than going stir crazy by being locked down like everybody else. So in the midst of lockdown, once or twice, I went, Lord, is this what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life? Surely, surely this isn't what I signed up for. And every time I said that, the Spirit said to me, mate, this is exactly what you signed up for. Exactly. I was never really happy with that response. But the amazing thing is that when we come to the end of a season like that, and I prepare a series like something like the Sermon on the Mount. Now, I've preached pieces of it before, but I've never preached through the whole Sermon on the Mount. And I find that my heart is still awakened, that my heart is still alive and excited at the prospect of preaching this, then I know that I'm still called to do this thing that I do. Amen. All right? So every week when I doubt my call, like most pastors do, but they don't tell you, all right? Every week when I doubt my call, when I come to something that enthuses me, that inspires me, that makes me go, Lord, I just want to preach this, I know that this is where I still belong. Thank you, Jesus. So last week, we were very blessed because we had Anita and David Roos with us in the worship, weighing, and waiting weekend. And Anita, unbeknownst to her, preached an introduction to the Sermon on the Mount from the book of James, where the language is incredibly similar. And the book of James, read properly, is a book all about grace, not about law. But it was quite amazing that unbeknownst to her, she didn't know we were going into this series, she did the introduction, but I'm going to reintroduce it for you. So with the Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus does, what he gives us, as it were, is a compass that indicates true north. It's the very ethic of the kingdom of God. And what we find there is counterintuitive to human nature. Human nature says if somebody strikes you on the cheek, then you lead with the left, right? And you finish the conflict with a right cross. That's what human nature says. So the Sermon on the Mount is often counterintuitive. And sometimes even Christian programs, I look at things that people offer that call you to be more assertive, to assert your will and your way, and there's this kind of militant Christianity that I don't know where people get it from. I really don't know where they get it from because the Sermon on the Mount is counterintuitive. It's the inverted nature of the kingdom. So when people say and think, as we often do, well, why doesn't God do something to change the situation? What we usually miss is that he actually is doing something. We assume that if God were really in control, he'd send in the tanks, right? He'd send the missiles. He'd sort out the corruptors. He'd launch the missiles, release the hounds, stop the unscrupulous, halt the bullies and the corruptors and the divisive and the tyrannical from getting away with what they get away with. But according to Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, when God wants to change the world, he doesn't send in the troops. He doesn't send in the ships and the tanks and the missiles and the trigger happy. He sends in you and me. The meek. And the mourners. And the merciful. And the justice hungry. And the poor in spirit. And the peacemakers. Not the peacekeepers, the peacemakers. You remember Anita spoke about the difference between peacekeeping and peacemaking. And the incorruptibly pure in heart. That's who he sends. Those are the beatitudes. Those are the blessings which we will deal with one by one. And those blessings, those beatitudes, were never ever a list of characteristics that you and I needed to try and achieve in order to get into heaven. Never. They were never that thing. They were always a list of the best of human qualities through which God would bring his heaven to bear on his earth. When heaven and earth collide, They are the means by which heaven collides with earth. God's heaven collides with God's earth. By the way, if you're looking for notes on Tithely, you're not going to find them because I forgot completely about it. But these are the means by which heaven collides with earth. Because by the time that the arrogant and the bullies and the trigger happy and the militant have woken up, by the time that the hounds have been released, by the time the trigger has been pulled, the meek and the peacemakers and the justice hungry and the incorruptibly pure have built schools and hospitals and universities and orphanages and are looking after the sick and the wounded and feeding the hungry that have been created by the arrogant bullies. This is and always has been the way of God's kingdom. These are the things that send the message of the kingdom into the world. And thanks be to God, these are the things that the church through the ages has done, even although it's not easily acknowledged by the pagan surrounds. Our story, the gospel story, is not a power story. It is a love story. The love that drove Jesus to the cross is the power that rescues the world. Now, today might sound a little different from an average sermon, and I hope that your ears prick up and I hold you for another 10 minutes or so. I want to start talking about four historical figures who were deeply impacted by Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And at least one of the four was not a Christian, in case you think that Jesus only influences Christians. At least another one of the four was a Christian of a kind, but not the kind that you and I usually think of. A third was an outstanding Christian, but someone who has often been vilified by uber-conservative Christians. He's one of my heroes of the faith. The fourth was a Christian who, although clearly evangelical, has been claimed by every Christian tradition under the sun because everybody wants a piece of him. All four of them have passed away. And I'm drawing attention to these four historical figures, not to give them any glory. They're all famous and well-known enough in their own right and hugely respected in their own right, but to illustrate that the influence of our King and his kingdom extends way beyond the confines and constraints of the church and of those of us who follow Jesus intentionally. His influence is way, way bigger than that. So I'm going to start with a Hindu. What Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi thought about the sermon and about Jesus. Gandhi had a philosophy called Satyagraha, which was radically influenced by Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. The concept of Satyagraha became a nonviolent path for truth in line with the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount. Gandhi said, "It was the New Testament which really awakened me to the value of passive resistance." Now, I'm not trying to make any claim on Gandhi's life here, that he was a follower of Jesus. But he saw something in Jesus' life. He saw the New Testament as a book of peace. He saw the New Testament as a book of peace. Many, many Christians throughout the ages could have taken a leaf out of Gandhi's book. The New Testament is a book of peace. Gandhi said, "I can discover no justification in the New Testament for wars of any kind whatsoever." He considered Jesus as the sower of the seed of nonviolent philosophy. He recognized that Jesus overcame evil with good and overcame hatred with love. He was heard to say, "I love your Jesus, but I'm not that fond of you Christians." Who could blame him, since his country was under the yoke of, at that time, Christian England as a colony? Then slightly closer to our own tradition, and this one might catch most of you off guard, Winston Churchill. I've been wanting to talk about this guy for a while. Now, we don't traditionally think of Churchill as a devout Christian. I mean, the man smoked like a chimney and he drank like a camel at an oasis after a 4-week sojourn through the desert. He was no Puritan, to be sure. Here's a beautiful quote of his I stumbled upon while reading a book written by his grandson called God and Churchill. Churchill was told during World War II that he couldn't imbibe in smoking and drinking when he went to meet the King of Saudi Arabia because the King of Saudi Arabia was a Muslim. Churchill responded, "If it is his religion that makes him say such things, please tell him that my religion prescribes as absolute sacred ritual smoking cigars and drinking alcohol before, after, and if needs be, during all meals and at every possible interval in between." What's not to love, right? Now, that's not what we really think of when we think about being Christian. But there was more to this man's Christian spirituality and indeed his faith. And I'm going to use that word, indeed his faith, than meets the eye. At 16 years of age, the young Winston Churchill had a spirit-given vision for his life's purpose, which he shared with his best friend at Harrow. And his best friend at Harrow said that at the time he heard it, he thought it was the deluded sense of grandeur of a teenager. He said in 1891 to his friend, at 16 years of age, "This country will be subjected somehow to a tremendous invasion. I shall be in command of the defenses of London. And it will fall to me to save the capital and the empire." On June 18 of 1940, 49 years later, Churchill said this in his speech, "I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization." He knew by providence that there was something enormous at stake. He was raised by a Christian nanny, Elizabeth Everest, who sowed the seeds of the gospel and his purpose in God's kingdom in him from a very early age. They remained friends until his death. His parents were not Christian, but his nanny was. And under her tutelage, he had memorized the entire Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. I've memorized portions of it, but not all of it. One of the Beatitudes in the sermon is mercy, and some people have made Churchill out to be a warmonger, and I don't think it's true. Here are his words on the Beatitude of Mercy. "The finest combination in the world," he said, "is power and mercy." Churchill's continuous hope was for peace. In 1936, which was the year of the Berlin Olympics, just preceding World War II, he urged the League of Nations, which preceded the United Nations, to invite the German people to join this organization of world security, where he said we can invite them to take their place in the circle of nations to preserve world peace. He recognized that the terms of the Versailles Treaty were inhumane and that if Germany was not invited to sit around the table, it would lead to war again. He made a study of the leadership style of Moses in the Old Testament. And as a young man, he experienced God miraculously delivering him from the Boers, my people. That's who I am. I'm a Boer, Afrikaner, stock, South African. He experienced God miraculously delivering him from the Boers in South Africa. He ascribed these words to that deliverance: "Without the assistance of that high power, which interferes with the eternal consequences and sequences of cause and effect, more often than we are prone to admit, I could never have succeeded. I prayed long and earnestly for help and guidance. My prayer, as it seems to me, was swiftly and wonderfully answered." And he escaped. He spoke about Deuteronomy 9 being a message full of insurance. He told his wife Clementine that one must yield oneself to the mood of the game and trust in God. He said in the face of rising evil in Germany that it is our duty to preserve the structure of the humane, enlightened Christian society. There can never be a friendship between British democracy and the Nazi power that spurns Christian ethics and cheers its onward course by a barbarous paganism. In 1946, after the war, considering the new emerging threat of Marxist communism, he told the, the Conservative Party in Britain that its main objective should be to uphold the Christian religion and to resist all attacks upon it. The flame of Christian ethics, he said, is still our highest guide, and the more closely we follow the Sermon on the Mount, the more we are likely to succeed in our endeavors. And then he had a cigar and a drink. Let me close on Churchill by sharing a short interaction between him and Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt was concerned that a meeting in Cairo might expose him and Winston to Luftwaffe bombing. Churchill responded in his cable to Roosevelt just by sending this biblical text, John 14, verses 1 to 4, which many of you would have memorized. Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God and believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. Now, I know, and I say it regularly, that politicians in our times and in his times and in all times use the name of God and Jesus in vain all of their time for their own selfish agenda. But one gets the feeling when you study this man's life that God raised him up for such a time as World War II, and that he had this providential sense of guidance and destiny all throughout his life. Certainly not a model for individual piety and holiness, for sure. Yet there was something bigger at play here. A man who, however we choose to judge him, not that that's ours to do, was deeply impacted, and that is the point, by Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. So we've done two. Here's our third figure. And this dude is a hero of mine. Our third historical figure who radically was impacted by the Sermon on the Mount was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. King said that he got his inspiration from Jesus Christ and his techniques from Mohandas K. Gandhi. And for King, these principles needed to be embraced as a lifestyle. He spoke of the formation of a beloved community. That was a church community that would transcend the barriers of race and ethnicity. It was not a utopian goal to be confused with the metaphorical biblical language of the consummated kingdom in which lions and lambs lie together. By the way, that's got nothing to do with carnivores becoming vegetarians. That's got to do with Gaddafi and Menachem Begin sitting around the same table, right? That's what that is about. For King, the beloved community was a realistic and an achievable goal. The beloved community was the outworking of seeking first the kingdom in the here and now, Matthew 6:33, slap bang in the middle of our sermon. And from his perspective, this might be achieved by a sizable number of like-minded peacemakers. People committed to and trained in the philosophy and methods of nonviolent peacemaking. King's message was and still is a distinctly Christian message, a message thoroughly motivated by the principles of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, a message addressed to all people of goodwill everywhere. In his vision, racism and sexism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice would be replaced by an all-inclusive familial spirit of brother and sisterhood. And so, of course, he was accused of being an idealist. I've been accused of being an idealist. I gladly receive that accusation. As my countryman Gary Player, the famous golfer, says, if you aim at nothing, you're sure to hit it every single time. For him, the beloved community, even in global disputes, would be resolved by peaceful conflict resolution and reconciliation of adversaries instead of invasion, instead of by military power, the kind of stuff we're seeing in the world right now. Love and trust triumph over fear and hatred. Peace and justice prevail over war and over military conflict. His message is as relevant now as it was then. We leave Dr. King with one quote that illustrates the Sermon on the Mount in action. This he said a couple of months before he was assassinated. With every ounce of our energy, We must continue to rid this nation of the incubus of segregation. But we shall not in the process relinquish our privilege and our obligation to love. While abhorring segregation, we shall love the segregationist. This, he said, is the only way to create the beloved community, and for that he was taken out. Tragically, King was assassinated in his attempt to live out the Sermon on the Mount in the face of mounting bigotry and intolerance. So I haven't said this yet, but living this way, like Jesus himself, living by the Sermon on the Mount, will not always win us friends and influence people. It will not always be popular. It will as often as not win us enemies. The way of Jesus is not a popular way. The way of peacemaking, meekness, is not a popular way. Our last historical figure is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Everybody wants a piece of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, right? And his story is quite incredible. A pastor, a theologian, a spy, who along with Martin Niemöller established the Confessing Church in Germany in World War II. It was a group of German pastors who opposed Adolf Hitler and the Nazi established Reichskirche. The Reichskirche actually had reformed Christian doctrine. They'd Nazified it to suit their purposes. And Bonhoeffer and others said, we cannot go this route. Now, despite having been profoundly influenced by the Sermon on the Mount, and this is the most difficult part of today's message, and living his life by the Sermon on the Mount, he was eventually complicit in a plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler and hanged in 1945, 1 month before the end of the war. And his story prevents us with the disturbing and complicated question. Let me say this to you, please. There are no simple answers to complicated questions. Please. There are no simple answers to complicated questions. But his story presents us with the disturbing and complicated question as to whether there are limits to Romans 13, which calls for obedience to the state, and whether indeed there are limits to living out the Sermon on the Mount. That's what his story presents us with. And I'm not going to try and convince you one way or another outside of saying that since the Sermon on the Mount is not a new law, it is a way of life and our north-pointing compass rather than an absolute standard that might never be veered from. In the face of absolute undiluted evil, is it possible that Christians might be called upon to do what Bonhoeffer did? I can't answer that for you. You have to answer that for yourself. You have to do the work. But I promise you it's not a simple answer. And it's not a simple question. I leave the question unanswered. What we do know, that Bonhoeffer's context for the interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount shares significant overlap with the New Testament writers' context. They were under Roman oppression, and Bonhoeffer is under Nazi oppression. Without going into the complexities of Bonhoeffer's theology, we could summarize it as from a quote in his book, Discipleship. By the way, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Discipleship, is obligatory reading for any Christian. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Discipleship, read it, please. Bonhoeffer begins discipleship with a direct question that focuses the Christian on Jesus and his life alone. What did Jesus want to say to us, he says? What does he want for us today? How does he help us to be faithful Christians today? It is ultimately, he says, important to know to us not what this or that church leader wants or what Milt wants. Rather, we want to know what Jesus wants. Almost like those little bangles that people sometimes wear, WWJD, right? What would Jesus do? So it becomes a meme, but it's a lot deeper than that. Who is this Jesus, he said, and what does he want from us? Now, for Bonhoeffer, I differ from him. He tended to read the Beatitudes as commands rather than as a moral compass. and there I differ from him. For him, it didn't matter if Jesus' commands seemed too difficult for normal Christians. Bonhoeffer rejects the notion that the Sermon on the Mount is optional. Rather, he places every Christian under the yoke of Jesus. He says that following the sermon might require painful separation from family and from nation. Regardless, the Christian is called to simply obey. Following Jesus under his light and easy yoke, Matthew 11:28-30. No matter how difficult such a life is, because Jesus is the one who leads, Bonhoeffer claims that discipleship is joy. Takes us back to our series in Philippians. Rejoice, I will say it again, rejoice. So, here we see yet another saint whose life was thoroughly impacted by the sermon. Can you imagine the wrestles of conscience that must have gone through this man's mind by the time he took the decision that Adolf Hitler needed to be taken out? Can you imagine the cognitive dissonance in a life that lived by the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, one can only imagine the wrestles of conscience he must have gone through to reach the place that he ultimately reaches regarding incarnate evil. Let me summarize the sermon from the perspective. Those are our four characters. I want to summarize the sermon from the perspective that we will be dealing with it. Firstly, Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount is not a collection of religious rules to be followed. You are the salt of the earth, but the salt has lost its taste. How shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. Matthew 5:13. It is not a collection of religious rules to be followed, because God has always been after your and my heart. No matter what we do, no matter how many religious rules we follow or good deeds we accomplish, the assurance that Paul gave the Roman church and us is that all of us fall short of the glory of God. There is no plausible or conceivable way to earn God's love, his salvation, and his grace. They are gifts. You have been gifted with salvation and grace. You cannot earn it. The Sermon on the Mount is a north-pointing compass, not a list of rules. When Jesus sits down to teach his disciples, he's teaching them what it means to be truly blessed. Beatitude means blessing. What it means to be truly blessed. You are truly blessed when you live in this way, when you pray in this way, the Lord's Prayer, which we will deal with when we get there, and how to live our daily lives in harmony with the Creator of our hearts. The Sermon on the Mount is an invitation to us to live by grace. The Sermon on the Mount is not a new law whereby Jesus replaces the Old Testament law. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them. I have come to fulfill them. Matthew 5:17. How many of you were here when I preached the 10-week series on grace in 2018 and 19? 3, 4 of you. 5. We have a new church. We have a new church. When was the law fulfilled? That's not a rhetorical question. When was the law fulfilled? When were all things finished? At the cry, it is finished. At that point on the cross, the old covenant is no longer relevant, and the new covenant of grace enters the equation. It is finished. It is completed. To live by law is to reject the new covenant. And it looks like I've got to go back to preaching 15 weeks on grace, and I'm going to do that. The Old Testament and the New Testament combined provide the complete history of our salvation. Jesus' teaching would have seemed radical to the listening disciples, but he wasn't reinventing the wheel. He was giving them the picture of the kingdom that was coming in their midst through him and had been hinted at in the Old Testament. There are echoes of Psalm 72 and other psalms in the sermon. This is not new. But the disciples were missing so much of the complete picture that it was hard for them to wrap their minds around what Jesus was saying, because they were used to religion and they were used to all the rules and all the laws that they had to follow all of their lives to be counted worthy of God. And this is not that. Then thirdly, Jesus speaks directly into our anxieties. Do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, or about your body or what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? Matthew 6:25. True to the form of the king of our hearts, Jesus, in teaching on the hillside, senses the panic amongst his listeners. Now, no one can live up to this teaching. No one can live up to this. And he points his followers beyond the basics of human existence to a picture of what life in the kingdom could be like. Even if food and drink and clothing become scarce and people are locked down and alone and isolated, even in desperate times, perhaps especially in desperate times, we can live out the values of the Sermon on the Mount. When we follow Jesus, we put our trust in who he is, not our capabilities. God is our provider, our defender, our creator. He is faithful and compassionate. There is nothing that you can do to lose his love. Nothing. If there's somebody sitting here this morning who feels that sin that I've committed, God cannot forgive, I'm going to reprimand you. How dare you limit the forgiveness of God? How dare you limit the forgiveness of God? There is no sin that is beyond our Savior to resolve. And then lastly, the Sermon on the Mount revealed something of Jesus' authority. When Jesus had finished these sayings, the crowd were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority, not like their religiously uptight scribes and Pharisees. Matthew 7:28 and 29. Jesus reveals here more of his true identity as he preaches the Sermon on the Mount. They recognize something of his divinity in the teaching. He spoke with an authority here that they hadn't previously witnessed. The authority of God blanketed the hillside by the Sea of Galilee as Jesus teaches the Sermon on the Mount. So the Sermon on the Mount, to wrap it, encourages us in terms of the possibilities for life in the kingdom. Can you imagine a community who lives by those north-pointing principles? But the most incredible thing we get from the passage is a clear picture of Jesus. His authority and a deep appreciation for the supernatural divinity residing in each Christ follower that allows us to respond to certain situations with meekness. Now, meekness is a really weak English word. But if you look at the Greek, what it means is there's a strength there that's already there. The picture is actually of a horse, but where there is a bit placed in that horse's mouth and the existing strength is steered in the right direction. That's what meekness is. Where God takes the strength that he's given you and he steers it in the right direction. There is a supernatural divinity residing in each Christ follower. It is him flowing through you and me that accomplishes any good that we might do. That's an introduction to the Sermon on the Mount. And we're going to spend a good few weeks here. And once we've done that, I'm going to spend a good few months reteaching grace. You are saved by grace, and that through faith, not by works. Lest anyone should boast. When you arrive in heaven and the angel says to you, why are you here? Why are you allowed to be here? Anything that you say that starts with I disqualifies you. I'm here because he Because he has done it. He has bestowed on me the gift of grace. He has bestowed on me the gift of faith. Because he.
Thank you for listening. We hope you can join us again next time. Be blessed.